This is Radio Boston. I'm Doug Tribune.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's begin today with more local reaction to the nuclear deal with Iran. The accord concluded yesterday would significantly limit Tehran's nuclear program for more than a decade in return for lifting international sanctions.
Critics, including many Republicans and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, are calling it a grave mistake that will empower a dangerous regime. But this afternoon at the White House, President Obama responded to the critics, even as he acknowledged that the deal is not perfect.
But this deal is our best means of assuring that Iran does not get a nuclear weapon. And from the start, that has been my number one priority, our number one priority.
We've been hearing reaction this week from members of Massachusetts' congressional delegation. Yesterday, we heard from Congressman Seth Moulton. Today, Congressman Stephen Lynch. And welcome to the program, Congressman Lynch. Good to have you.
Good to be with you, Anthony.
So we just heard the president there saying that this deal is our best means of assuring that Iran does not get a nuclear weapon. Do you agree with that? Is he right?
Well, I think we are on the horns of a dilemma. I think that if we do nothing, there's a very short window or timeline when Iran may, in fact, have a nuclear weapon. So that I think the president's goal here is to try to lengthen out that period, which we can be assured that Iran does not develop a weapon. The problem here is that we're dealing with Iran, and they've got a long history of abusing agreements and being caught in untruthful statements and violating previous agreements. And actually conducting nuclear research that was they earlier denied. So there's a certain treacherous history here.
There's history, but doesn't a deal like this, I mean, just the fact that it keeps the U.S. and its allies engaged with Iran, even if the deal is imperfect, I mean, it seems like it would increase the chances that the West could be aware of what's going on, could stay aware of what's going on.
Well, it could leave us in a worse position as well. And look, I'm not trying to, you know, douse cold water on the president's agreement. I'm hopeful that we can be successful in this. But there are gaps. I've had a chance to meet with former IAEA inspectors this morning, after they had a chance to digest the agreement and talk about the concerns that they have. They're worried about the inspection regime, which is really an essential part of this whole thing. They're worried that they will not be given unfettered access, number one. They're worried that in some cases there's a 24-day delay before they can get access to sites that they want to inspect. They're concerned that there are administrative hurdles that they would have to overcome in order to do their jobs, and that the agreement in itself is silent on the issue of on-site inspections. So they're concerned about being able to do their job, and if they're concerned, then I need to be concerned, because you know the heart of this is the ability. So the value of this agreement is the ability to monitor, to understand where Iran is right now and where they will be in the future. There is the biggest role for any individual group in this agreement, ironically, is the IAEA. They are responsible for, you know, making sure that centrifuges are disassembled, that they are stored, that the Calandria at the, you know, the heavy water facility is disabled, that the uranium is only enriched to, you know, 3.67%.
Yeah, a lot of technical specifications.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And so if they are denied the opportunity to do their job, then this agreement really is not worthwhile. So
can I, Congressman, let me ask you about another concern that's been raised. A number of Republicans have raised this. Senator John McCain predicted that Iran would continue their aggression across the Middle East and now would be able to fund their conquests with money pouring in from the West, that the result of the embargo being lifted. Are you concerned about that?
I am. I'm the ranking Democrat on the terrorist financing task force here in the House. And so you have to realize, Anthony, that about half of our sanctions against Iran are related to the nuclear threat. The other half are the result of Iran's activity in funding Hamas, in funding Islamic Jihad, in funding Hezbollah. So we've actually gone in and done sanctions, and President Bush did a terrorist financing executive order. So we've got, a lot of evidence there that the Iranian banks that are now going to receive relief were actually involved in this terrorist funding and money laundering enterprises. So we are giving them relief because they're promising to adopt good conduct with respect to their nuclear aspirations. However, they've promised us nothing with respect to the Houthis rebels in Yemen and the other groups that I mentioned.
I want to ask you this, though. We talked to Seth Moulton yesterday, and he had some questions. He wasn't being Pollyannish about this agreement by any means, but he raised the question, what's the alternative? And for him, the alternative was a much greater risk of war. And so, on balance, it sounded like he was coming down on this is an agreement that we've got to get behind because the alternative would be so much worse.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree with him. I don't disagree with him. The only alternative to this would be open conflict with Iran, and that's a very, very grim prospect. That's just not something that I think rational people would entertain at this point.
Speaking of
however,
open, yeah, go ahead,
however,
Congressman.
However, there is the other possibility where, we allow their economy to get back online, and believe me, there's a lot of good in this agreement for Iran, their auto industry, their textile industry, their oil industry, everything, their financial services industry, everything comes back up online, and he's right, Seth is right, the money, there's $120 billion in frozen assets that roll back into the Iranian treasury, and suppose they breach at some point, I don't believe that we have snap back sanction ability. I think it's going to be very difficult to get some of the countries that are on board now to come on back on board later. And I think that the $120 billion or so that's in foreign banks now and frozen, when that becomes unfrozen, it's going to wash back into the Iranian treasury, and we will definitely not be able to snap that back once the Iranians have their money in their hands. So
I see. So yes,
those are concerns as well.
Big concerns. Well, speaking of the challenges of open conflict in that region, you recently returned from a trip to the Middle East. You visited Kuwait, Turkey, and Iraq to look closely at terrorism financing and ISIS. President Obama recently ordered the deployment of an additional 450 American troops to the region, to Iraq, bringing the total to more than 3,500 troops. Are you worried about this return of American boots on the ground?
I'm concerned about it. Yeah, I am. Doing the same thing again. Remember, we already trained up between 2003 and 2011. We trained up about 938,000 Iraqis. That includes their border patrol, the Iraq National Army, and their police force. And at the end of all that training, a much smaller group of ISIL fighters were able to roll up a considerable part of that country. We also spent $25 billion equipping those Iraqi troops, and we lost 4,500 good Americans. Now, the new plan looks very much like the old plan, which is we're going to try to teach them how to fight, and we're going to re-equip them. That did not work the first time, so I'm very skeptical. And in talking with the folks up on the Kurdish areas and out, we met with about seven of the sheikhs from Anbar province. as well as the leadership in Baghdad, you know, there's still the expectation there in many of their minds that the U.S. is going to come back in there with big, big numbers like we did back in 2003. And we tried to disabuse them of that notion, but...
Well, what has to happen? I mean, absent big numbers of American troops, what has to happen in Iraq? I mean, as you mentioned, we saw the fall of Ramadi recently to ISIS fighters.
Right.
So what
has to... They're not working together, though. You know, the Kurds are fighting. You know, they have been somewhat successful. They took back Mosul Dam. They have taken a bunch of territory there, albeit with the assistance of U.S. air power and British air power, Jordanian air power, but... You know, there's a willingness to fight within those Kurdish areas. I think it stops at Mosul. I think that's probably the limit of what they consider their own territory. The Sunni, some of them are complicit with ISIL, but others are on the fence, and there's no confidence from their point of view in the Baghdad government. They see the Baghdad government as embracing, you know, Shia militants, and so there's a rift there.
But let me just ask you one final question about this. Sure. I mean, given these challenges and given your understandable concern about committing more large numbers of American troops on the ground again, and I think a lot of people in Massachusetts can share that concern, what of the argument that, you know, the Americans went in there, we broke it, we need to fix it?
It was broken before we went in there. If you think that's what Saddam Hussein had going, look, he had used chemical weapons against his own people. He had invaded Kuwait. He fought a 10-year war with Iran. He fired Scud missiles into the civilian populations in Israel. He had attacked everybody on his border except for Syria. Mm. So, you know, we didn't break anything. We tried to help. We trained up all those people. We equipped them. We lost far too many good Americans in doing that. And what we fought for was to give them the chance, to control their own destiny and to come together and have a decent country with some level of democracy, some level of human rights. Now, they have squandered that. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people blame Nouri al-Maliki. I think there's more blame, you know, blame should be spread more widely than just him. But that division between Kurd, between Shia, between Sunni was insurmountable by us. It's only going to be able to be addressed by them.
Well, big questions. Another part of the world where there are no easy answers. Congressman Stephen Lynch represents the 8th District in Massachusetts. Thanks for talking to us today. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you, Anthony.